Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
It was 100 years ago that a German submarine with a single torpedo sunk the Lusitania cruise liner, killing nearly 1,200 people, 128 of them Americans. It is a story we think we all know, but don't really. So Eric Larson fills in the blanks for us with Dead Wake. He's made a career of sort of filling in the blanks of stories that we think we know. Eric, welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Tell me, you said once a quote, my favorite zone is from 1890 to 1915. Why is that?
Well, you know, I love, well, first of all, I should also qualify that and say, well, of course, I did do this book in the Garden of the Beast, which was 1934, so that's an outlier.
You're
but
not
that,
limited,
you know, there's
right,
an exception
right.
to every rule, right? It's because, I love that period, and it's where the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era overlap. I love it because that was a time when America, the thing that defined America, was sort of boundless confidence and optimism. And frankly, wherever you have boundless confidence and optimism, you have great stories, often, frankly, tragic.
Right. There's hubris there.
There's a lot of hubris there. In fact, I mean, if I had a chance, if I could, I would seriously think about doing a book about the Panama Canal. Unfortunately, the ultimate book about the Panama Canal has been done by David McCulloch, so I'm not even going to think about it. But, you know, it's this time where that kind of thing was going on.
McCulloch's tough competition, isn't it?
Tough competition. Yeah.
Take me back to 1915. I'm interested in, you know, when you write about this, you don't refer to World War I because we didn't know it as World War I.
Exactly.
But there's an active war very much going on in Europe, and yet people are still crossing. The Lusitania is just one of many ships going back and forth.
Right, right. Yeah. It's kind of an interesting moment in the history of the war, and in particular of naval warfare, because it was the Lusitania. Really, what the Lusitania marked was the definitive moment when the old rules governing naval warfare were discarded utterly by Germany, and the new rules, whatever they were ultimately going to be, were starting to evolve. The old rules were that you could never attack a civilian liner, and you had all kinds of rules governing when you attacked any kind of civilian merchant ship. You had to be, above all, you had to make sure the crew remained safe. Submarine changed all that. Nobody realized yet how much it changed all that. The Lusitania was that moment.
The Germans told the passengers that they were changing the rules, right? They took out an ad in the shipping newspapers.
Well, they said, you know, in fact, the ad appeared the very morning of Lusitania's departure. And what it did was it reiterated that Germany had created a war zone in the waters around the United Kingdom. And it stated that anybody, therefore, who traveled in those waters did so at their own risk. It did not specifically mention the Lusitania. It was sort of a general warning placed by the German embassy.
But they was it the Washington Times wrote a piece, I think, after there was a tank or something shot, torpedoed,
right.
And they were almost tracking it. I mean, they said, and the Lusitania is moving into that area.
Yeah, but even though the ad never mentioned the Lusitania, interestingly, it was, for example, in the New York World, the warning was placed right next to an ad for the Lusitania that Cunard had placed in the shipping news pages. There was widespread belief that the advertisement, the warning, was in fact aimed at the Lusitania simply because of the timing. It turns out that was actually not the case. It was a weird coincidence, one of many involving the ship. But there was actual speculation in American newspapers about the ultimate safety of the Lusitania as it was a day or two into its voyage.
One of the beauties of any Eric Larson book is that we're introduced to people that we did not know before and end up caring about through the pages. And I want to start with Dwight Harris,
yes.
Young man who's going to be engaged, I believe, in England or Scotland, but what I remember about him are his exclamation points. Tell me about you can point that out in the book.
He's not the biggest character in
no.
the book, but he is my favorite character. He's a young guy from New York. I came across a very long letter that he wrote after the disaster. He wrote this to his mother. And what I loved about this letter was, first of all, it had a lot of detail, which is crucial if you're going to write what people refer to as narrative nonfiction, because, mm-hmm. you know, you can't fake it. You got to have it, right? So he wrote this lovely long letter, and it was just brimming with his enthusiasm at not just having survived, but also at having been part of this terrific historical event. And so, like, every other sentence is just full of exclamation points and, you know, how this and that, 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 you know. It's just really a very sweet letter.
Another is, and I'm not sure I'll pronounce her name correctly, is Theodate Pope?
You did that correctly, yeah. Okay. We can call her Theo if
Theo,
you like.
Theo, okay. Tell me about Theo.
Yeah, so what I like about Theo, well, first of all, anybody who's in the book is in there for one reason. They left a lot of detail behind, and that's, like I say, that's crucial.
They decide who your characters are going to be, don't they? I
mean, they decide. Right. Yeah, they decide for me. So Theodate left a lot of material behind, and also she, too, left a very detailed account to her mother as well, but much more detailed, much more sober, not a whole lot of exclamation points in her case. I liked about her, she was one of America's first, if not the first, licensed female architects. And she was also one of that cadre of women who was first to embrace the term feminist for herself. But she was also depressed, and part of her story, part of her backstory I really like is the how she went about before getting onto the ship in the years before dealing with depression, mm-hmm. because that gave an insight into kind of, you know, how the world dealt with a problem that we all today are very familiar with. And just knowing that it existed way back when and how they dealt with it was really kind of a good thing, a connection to the current day.
We don't have time for it here, but just a remarkable passage about a doctor in Philadelphia and how he treated women and the way things have changed.
His rest cure, yeah.
Then there's Walter Schwieger.
Yeah, Schwieger. Technically the correct German pronunciation.
The captain of U-20, the U-boat that shot down, or I keep saying shot down, but that torpedoed the Lusitania. And he's almost a sympathetic character here.
Well, much to my surprise, I mean, when I set out to do the book, I was frankly hoping that the submarine commander would be just the classic villain. You know?
Right.
I mean, you know, give me a scar and a monocle and I'm there, right?
But this guy wouldn't hurt a fly.
Well, his friends say. That's what one of his friends said. He would not hurt a fly.
He clearly would hurt a fly.
He did not, alas, he did not wear a monocle. He was a young, handsome guy, 30, good-looking, blue eyes, charismatic. His crew loved him. He was well-liked throughout the submarine service. And, you know, that one fellow commander said of him that, you know, he could not hurt a fly.
There were conflicting accounts afterward. I think it was a former girlfriend or someone said he was sort of racked with guilt by this act, but then other evidence doesn't indicate that. What do you think?
Right. I mean, she said that he was shattered by it, and some of the things in her account suggest a close knowledge of what a submarine commander actually had to deal with. However, then she says that, you know, he was so racked that he just couldn't fire another torpedo at a ship, you know. And then, but meanwhile, after sinking the Lusitania, you know, within like 10 minutes, he took a shot at another ship.
Right.
And missed. But he did take that shot. So it's like, you know, I don't know. I don't know how credible her account was.
All right, let's go to that day then. The passengers on the ship, many of them talking about the idea of a torpedo, some of them romanticizing about the idea of even being attacked in this. It's a clear day. It's a beautiful day. They're on the deck, and they can actually see the torpedo coming to them.
Right, right. Yeah, it was one of the things that really stood out to me in my research was the kind of day that was. There had been heavy fog that morning. It really sort of miraculously lifted and left one of the most beautiful days that anybody could ever remember. You know, cloudless sky, still, no wind. The sea was said to be just absolutely glassy. I mean, nobody could remember this kind of glassy sea. And then suddenly, you know, here they are. They're all feeling at this point safe. They're feeling like the threat is over. Mm-hmm. The next day they're going to arrive early in the morning. They're going to arrive at Liverpool. And then those on deck who are standing at the rail looking out at the sea suddenly see the wake of this torpedo suddenly emerge and come steadily toward the ship. And the sense of disbelief was the most prevalent. Although one guy, this is the one reason I love this era. I mean, one guy, this is a classic reaction, you know, from that kind of era of confidence and optimism and so forth. Guy runs to the rail to watch the torpedo as it hits the ship. And he says later, it was the torpedo moving through that clear sea, you know, 10 feet below the surface, was to him a really beautiful sight, as he put it.
You write then about the rescue and about the people of Ireland who do their best to save as many people as they can. But in those moments or in those hours in the water, there are at least two people who, as the ship is submerging, are sucked into one of the chimneys, the towers, right? And then spewed out.
Well, that was another thing. Yeah, the ship had four funnels, which vented the boiler rooms below, and these funnels were gigantic. At the top, they were about 24 feet across. And as the ship was doing its finally submerging, and the funnels were going under, and water, of course, was flowing into them. Actually, three people were sucked into to one funnel, and because of a steam explosion below, were blown out of the funnel, alive.
They survived.
And covered in soot, but alive.
And then there's the case, and I keep running down just names, but you probably would agree, is about their individual stories.
Yeah.
They're about the people. There's this young boy, Robert Kay.
Right.
And he's the one who had measles, right?
He has measles,
and he's sort of, so he's quarantined. He's with his mother, who's very pregnant. They get separated after the torpedo attack. And he hears an account that a woman had actually given birth in the water.
Right. And yeah.
Was that his mom?
He forever afterwards thought that it probably was.
Do we know that it happened?
We know that somebody gave birth in the water.
We do, okay.
We don't know that it was his mother. His mother was lost. So we have no idea. He and his mother were separated. He survived. She did not.
All of the people I've been running down here, I've left toward the end here, Captain Turner, who was a remarkable guy, a stoic man. It seems as if he did what he thought was best all the way through. And yet, here he is in command of this terrible event. People sort of, as soon as they get to Ireland, people turn on him, hold him responsible.
Right.
And then the British government, Winston Churchill and others, try to blame him. And I don't yet know why that is.
Well, first of all, Turner was, in fact, a very, very capable captain, really, truly a veteran. But, he was confronting a situation. He was confronting a situation that actually his training, no one's training as a civilian captain of an ocean liner had ever had prepared them for. And why he was finally, why the Admiralty attempted to blame him for the thing is very complicated. But the gist of it is that, first of all, it made no sense that they would try to blame him, because the publicity value of just simply laying it on Germany was huge. So then you have to ask yourself, why then would they blame the captain? And I think one major reason is to keep secret this very, very secretive entity within the Admiralty that had been allowing the Admiralty to read virtually all of Germany's naval communications from pretty much the start of the war.
They'd been tracking U-20.
They've been tracking U-20 to the extent that U-20 was able to send wireless messages. They knew exactly where it was during its first 24 hours. And they knew exactly where it was assigned to patrol, which was right off Liverpool, exactly in the waters that Captain Turner and Lusitania were scheduled to pass through.
You know, I don't want to cheat people who are going to read the book of all.
You got to be careful about spoilers. Yes,
I know, but
though we know the ending,
we always know the ending to your books, Eric. That's the beauty of it. You still make us read them. But really, maybe the most poignant moment for me was when we meet Captain Turner again.
Right.
And he's on another boat. Can we talk about that?
Well, we can talk about that because you already gave something critical away, but we'll talk about that.
I did. What did I give away?
Something.
Okay.
But anyway, suffice it to say. So later some shipping reporters took a trip up river, and there was a ship, kind of an old cargo ship full of horses. And actually, what was interesting about that ship was it was so full of horses that when the horses were spooked, they would move all in concert, and the ship itself would kind of rock at the wharf, which had by that time it was something that had come to be known as a horse storm,
right?
A horse storm. But so the hold opens as they pull up near the ship, and there inside the hold is a guy who turns out to be Captain Turner. You know, he's looking kind of careworn. His clothing is kind of worn. He's got his hat on, kind of cocked at an angle. But he's still the same old captain. He just doesn't look quite as snappy as he once did.
Still on the water.
Still on the water.
Yeah, I remember talking to you before. I don't remember after which book, but you referred to sort of your dark period after a book to where you're wrestling around for what's next.
Right.
And when you tease us with something like this, we all want to know what's next.
Yeah, and so do I. I don't have anything, frankly, on my plate. I've been looking into something, But I'm not sure that it's the thing next, but it might be. And it is, if it works, it is, by the way, smack dab in the center of that era that
in
I
your
love
period.
To work on.
Do you allow yourself to relax after you're done?
No.
You don't? I would
no.
imagine you wouldn't.
No, no.
Eric Larson, it's good to see you again.
Yeah, nice to see you. Thanks.
The name of the book, Dead Wake. I'm Steve Bertrand.